So let me introduce my recent collaborators. Most of the work that I'm going to talk about is done with a postdoc, Dominic Els, who was at MIT and then moved to Harvard and soon will, in fact, move to PIS faculty at the end of the summer. And so the more recent work is done with a student, Yingyan Chi, who's a grad student at MIT, a postdoc at Goldman, and some of the work is in collaboration with Ryan Thongren, who's now at KATP. Okay. So the plan of the lectures is the following. So in the first lecture, I'll motivate the problem, provide some motivation and some context, and the bulk of the lecture will be on emergent symmetries. And a concept which may be familiar to some of you called Etouffe anomalies in metals. And the second lecture, I will report some progress on the simplest model for quantum phase criticality of Fermi surfaces. So Fermi surface coupled to a critical Landau-Oder parameter. Okay, so let me start with some motivation and context. So there are many reasons to study quantum criticality that many people have. For me personally, one of the things that drives my interest in quantum criticality is that it provides a route to understanding how the standard theory of metals may break down in a real system. So conventional metals are described by Fermi liquid theory. So an ordinary metal like copper, the effect of the inter-electron Coulomb repulsion is weakened due to the Pauli exclusion principle. And the low energy theory of the metal is described in terms of quasi-particles, which are fermions with electric charge E and spin half that fill up a Fermi C in momentum space. And so these quasi-particles are just versions of the underlying electrons, and they live very long near the Fermi surface and have a well-defined energy-momentum relation. And the low energy effective theory of a Fermi liquid is described entirely in terms of these quasi-particles that live near the Fermi surface of a metal. So this theory is called Landau's Fermi liquid theory. And as I said, it's very successful in describing all kinds of metals. Now, in the last 30 years or so, there's a large number of metals have been discovered which do not seem to be described by Fermi liquid theory. And some of these violate Fermi liquid physics down to extremely low temperature. A famous example, perhaps the most prominent example, is in the phase diagram of the high temperature superconductors. Probably all of you have seen this phase diagram before. These materials start off as insulators, and then you dope them, you get a superconductor, but in a wide range of a regime of the phase diagram, there are metals that are completely different from anything that looks like a Fermi liquid. Okay. And there are several other metals that are tuned to a quantum critical point near the onset of magnetism or some other kind of order, where once again you see a breakdown of Fermi-Liquid physics. Now, the connection to quantum criticality comes from phase diagrams of this sort. So when you see a phase diagram of this sort, clearly it feels as though there is some chance that the non-Fermi-Liquid physics is associated with some quantum criticality related to a ground state phase transition between the ordinary Fermi-Liquid and whatever phase lurks in this portion of the phase diagram. It's commonly called the pseudo-gap phase. I won't get into what it is. But clearly, there's some change of ground state between the Fermi-Liquid and whatever the ground state is that underlies this behavior. And right near where that change occurs is where at the lowest temperatures, you get this non-Fermi-Liquid physics, right? And this looks, should remind you of the quantum critical fan that we're used to seeing near quantum critical points, okay? So understanding stained metals is one of the big challenges in contemporary physics. Now, how should we think about metals without the aid of quasiparticles, okay? There's many questions that one may be interested in. I'm particularly interested in understanding the nature of a coarse-grained, low-energy effective theory of such a non-Fermi-Liquid metal. And the hope is that such a theory will capture universal aspects of several strained metals, irrespective of their particular microscopic origins. Okay? So the strategy that I'm going to follow in these lectures, this applies, what I'm saying here applies particularly just to this first lecture. So I'm now, there's a lot of good reasons to try to do that, which I won't go into. There's some motivation from experiments, some motivation from theory, but this is what I'm going to do. Focus on idealized situations with no impurities, right? So let me start the main talk with some very general considerations. I want to think about global symmetry in quantum many-body physics, or if you wish, in quantum field theory. So we have some UV theory that could be defined on the lattice or something in the continuum. And this UV theory will have some Hilbert space, it will have some global symmetry group, which I'll call GUV. And then we're interested in the low energy effective theory, the theory of the fixed point or that controls the low energy behavior of the system. And I'll call that the IR theory. And this IR theory will have its own global symmetry group, GIR, and there'll be a map between these two symmetry groups, right? There'll be a map that embeds the UV symmetry group into the IR symmetry group. Now, throughout this talk, I'm going to be interested in situations where GUV is not spontaneously broken in the IR, right? So we'll see precisely what GUV, what the UV symmetry group is, and why I assume that it's not spontaneously broken in the IR theory. Okay, so lot of my lectures will focus quite a bit on the structure of global symmetry, particularly the IR symmetry group. So I want to make a few more comments on this on realization of symmetry. Now, the first comment is that GIR may be a bigger group than GUV. So this is the sort of formal way of saying something that we are very familiar with, that the IR theory may have emergent symmetry that's not there in the UV theory, right? So if it's a bigger symmetry group, then there are extra symmetry generators that are not present in the UV, and those extra symmetries are emergent symmetries. Okay, now a second property of this emergent symmetry group, IR, that will play a crucial role in my talk is something known as the Nathoost anomaly. The most familiar manifestation of this, the most familiar example of the Nathoost anomaly is the chiral, or sometimes what's called the axial anomaly of massless fermions, for instance, Dirac fermions in 3+1 dimensions. And this anomaly of this emergent symmetry, we'll see, will be constrained in some way by the structure of the UV theory. So why are these anomalies important? I'll explain what these anomalies are as we go along in the talk. These are toothed anomalies or topological properties of how symmetry is realized in a many-body system. They're topological in the sense that they're robust to deformations within the same phase of matter. Okay? So you could deform the phase of matter or the whatever fixed point you're studying. You could add the relevant operators or move along some fixed line, but all kinds of things may change along that fixed line if it exists, but the Tufte anomaly will not change, right? So in that sense, it's a robust, almost topological property of the realization of symmetry in the effective theory. So this means the focusing on the Tufte anomalies means that we focus on these topological aspects of how symmetry is realized. And this leads to a connection between the study of non-topological phase of matter, like quantum critical points, non-Fermi liquid metals, and so on, and this entire different branch of condensed matter physics, which is the study of topological phase of matter. Okay? So there's many insights that we gain by studying topological phases that will then inform our thinking on non-topological phase of matter, like quantum critical points, and more particularly, for this talk, non-Fermi liquid metals. Okay, so let me specify the UV global symmetry, GUV. I'm going to consider UV systems with the global internal U1 symmetry and lattice translation symmetries on a d-dimensional lattice. So this specifies the UV symmetry group completely. Now, in condensed matter physics, this global U1 symmetry corresponds to electric charge conservation, particle number conservation, and lattice translation is just what it is, right? So one thing that I'll not do in this first talk is to specify the Hamiltonian other than to require that it is local, meaning it is a sum of operators that each act on local regions of space, okay? So this includes almost all models of interest in standard discussions of strongly interacting electrons, the Hubbard model, various variants of the Hubbard model. It'll include, you know, quantum spin models, things of that sort. One interesting model that will not include are these things that have been discussed a lot in the last few years, these Sachdev-Yeh-Kitaev models. Those models have random interactions and random hopping. They have random interactions. Since I'm focusing on system models with lattice translation symmetries, I'll exclude models of that kind. There is a lot of interesting physics to be learned by focusing on translation invariant models, and that's what I'm going to do. Okay. So you can ask, how can you do any condensed matter of physics without knowing the Hamiltonian? So we'll see that indeed there's a lot that we can learn even without knowing what the Hamiltonian is. So I'm going to be focusing on compressible quantum matter. So what does the term compressibility mean? So let N be the generator of the global U1 symmetry. And so mu will be the corresponding chemical potential. Then there's a thermodynamic susceptibility that we can define, dN d mu, which is known as the compressibility. So I'll be interested in phase of matter where the compressibility is non-zero. So within such a phase where the compressibility is non-zero, the charge density can be tuned continuously. So the classic example of a compressible phase of matter is a free Fermi gas at some non-zero density. And all the non-Fermi liquid metals that I'm interested in understanding, they're all compressible. Okay. All right. So with global U1 and lattice translation symmetries, we can define a quantity known as the lattice filling, which is the average electrical charge per unit cell. To define this very precisely, let's say in two dimensions, take an L by L lattice and count the total charge inside this lattice. We have fermions at some finite density. So count the total charge and divide by the area, by the number of unit cells of this lattice, and take the thermodynamic limit of L going to infinity, number of particles going to infinity, while keeping the number of particles per unit cell fixed. And that is the defines the filling. So in a compressible phase, we can tune the filling nu continuously and not leave that particular phase of matter. Okay. So this much is about specifying the UV theory, right? I assume there's a global U1 and lattice translations. And I assume the theory is compressible and that it's characterized by some filling nu, which we can tune continuously. So that's all I'm going to assume. Okay. Now let's talk about how these symmetries can maybe realize in the IR theory. So as I said, I'm going to assume right away that neither the global U1 nor the lattice translation is broken in the IR theory. Not breaking global U1 simply means I'm assuming that I don't have a superconductor, right? I'm interested in the metal, so obviously I don't want a superconductor, right? And I'm interested in the metal that preserves the lattice translation symmetry of the UV, okay? There could be metallic phases which break the lattice translation spontaneously, but that's not the kind of theory that I'm interested in for purposes of my long-term goal of understanding non-fermi liquid phase of matter.
Santo?
Okay. Yeah?
Hi, it's Nicole Younger-Halpern. Is it okay if I ask a few questions?
Sure, please go ahead.
Thanks. And since I'm kind of an outsider to the field, these are going to be sort of basic questions. Sure. First, you said that mu can depend on the expectation value of the particle number. I usually think of mu as intensive and so as not varying with the system size. When is it, so how should I think of this thing that's like an intensive variable, plays a very similar role, but does depend on the system, or say the average number of particles?
There's two points of view as always, right? There's a canonical ensemble in which you fix the number of particles and then mu is a function of the number of particles. Right? It's the derivative of the free energy with respect to the number of particles. Or there's a grand canonical description where you fix mu and then the number of particles is determined by the derivative of the grand free energy with respect to the chemical potential.
Okay, and if the change in the average number of particles with respect to mu means that we can tune mu continuously, what is the reason for calling that particular situation compressible?
Right, so it means that you can change the charge density. It really means just what this sentence. You can change the charge density continuously. So this is what's called electronic compressibility. It should be distinguished from the compressibility of the solid as a whole. It just means that you can change the density. So you imagine compressing just the electronic fluid. Right? So you're changing the density that way. Right? So you're able to do that in a continuous manner.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Nicole, for your questions. So let's talk about lattice translations in the IR theory. I think it was Shailesh who mentioned in the introductory remarks, lattice gauge theorists are interested in taking the continuum limit of lattice models. So here I'm interested in the IR theory that describes my compressible phase of matter. So imagine that this IR theory is obtained by spatially coarse graining and taking the continuum limit of my UV theory. So naturally, a unit lattice translation in the UV theory, you might expect that it's realized as an infinitesimal translation in the IR theory. You know, in the continuum limit, what was in the UV lattice translation is going to appear as an infinitesimal translation of the continuum theory, right? So this is not a very precise statement, and that's why I put a tilde here. The more precise statement is that we should allow for action by an internal symmetry of the IR theory, right? And so this statement is nicely illustrated by the simple example. Think about an Ising antiferromagnet on a lattice. So an Ising model on a lattice with antiferromagnetic interactions, perhaps it orders antiferromagnetically. And let's say you do this even for a classical Ising model. You heat it up to its critical point. There's a phase transition, this second order phase transition. And the theory of that second order phase transition is described by standard continuum phi to the fourth theory, with phi being the coarse grain Landau order parameter for the antiferromagnet. Okay? Now let's ask about how a unit lattice translation of the UV theory is realized in this IR continuum phi to the fourth theory, right? So unit lattice translation clearly involves a flip of the Ising antiferromagnetic order parameter. So under what on the lattice was the translation by one lattice spacing is realized in the continuum by the transformation phi going to minus phi, which is an internal symmetry of this phi to the four scalar phi theory. Okay, so the precise statement is that after we coarse grain, unit lattice translations get mapped to internal symmetries of the IR theory. Now, there could be some exceptions to this. So the IR theory does not involve spatial coarse graining. Those are fairly exotic situations, which are being discussed currently in some discussion in condensed matter physics. But because these are exotic situations, I'm going to set this subtlety aside as a future worry. Okay? Basically just assume this for the rest of the talk. Okay. Let me give you some examples of how there are Hamiltonian free constraints on the UV or on the IR theory coming from the UV. Suppose I specify that the IR theory is fully gapped and is smoothly connected to a band insulator. Now, one of the basic results in solid state physics is that this is only possible if the UV theory has a lattice filling with nu even. So this is the statement that a band insulator is only possible in a system with an even number of electrons per unit cell, because only then can you completely fill some set of bands. So this statement, which is a very simple and fairly obvious statement, is wonderful because it's independent of any Hamiltonian. Right? The only way you can get a band insulator is if the lattice filling has even nu, irrespective of what the Hamiltonian of your system is. Okay. A more subtle example is also very famous, and it's known as Ludinger's theorem in Fermi liquids. So this is the statement that the volume of the Fermi surface is fixed by the electron filling in basically the same way as it is in a free Fermi gas. So in a free Fermi gas, the volume of the Fermi surface, you simply count the number of states that you're filling, and the volume of the Fermi surface in suitable units of the Boulmer zone volume is equal to the lattice filling nu, modulo an integer z, which counts the number of filled bands in the system. So this statement is true even in an interacting Fermi liquid. This was proven to all orders of perturbation theory by Ludinger in the 1960s. So it's a very important theorem. And it was given a non-perturbative justification by Yoshikawa more than 20 years ago. And this too is a Hamiltonian independent statement, so long as the ground state is a Fermi liquid. So that's the only assumption that goes into this statement. Okay, so this is sort of like a quantization condition. If you wish, it's a non-renormalization theorem about a Fermi liquid. Or you could think about it as something topological that tells you that the difference of the left and right hand sides is a quantized integer. it has the feel of something topological, and that was emphasized by Yoshikawa, this paper. So there are these famous examples of Hamiltonian independent statements that constrain the low energy physics, which come just from some general statements on symmetries of the system. So what I want to do is to revisit from a modern point of view Schrödinger's theorem, and I want to recast it as a statement about the emergent symmetry and the Sethoff anomaly of the low energy Fermi liquid theory. And the reason why this is a useful exercise is because these structures, the emergent symmetry and the Sethoff anomaly, are more general than Schrödinger's theorem. So Schrödinger's theorem is one consequence of this deeper structure. And what we would like to do is to generalize this deeper structure to other more general compressible phases that includes non-Fermi liquid metals. And then as a consequence of the generalization of the deeper structure, we can obtain statements which are the analogs of Schrödinger's theorem to contexts where the system is simply not a Fermi liquid. So let me illustrate the ideas with a very simple example in 1+1 dimensions. And we'll talk about compressible matter in 1+1 dimensions. So let's think about free fermions at non-zero density in 1D. By 1D, I mean one space dimension. Now the IR theory is obtained by linearizing the dispersion near the chemical potential. Right? So it's two Fermi points, Kf and minus Kf, and I linearize the dispersion. And the IR theory is the massless Dirac fermion. Right? And the global symmetry of the massless Dirac fermion in 1+1D is U1 cross U1, corresponding to separate conservation of the number of right movers and the number of left movers. Now we can add interactions to this theory, four fermion interactions, and that's well known that's a marginal perturbation to the free massless Dirac fermion, and it leads to a fixed line. Kinetic matter physicists call this a Schrödinger liquid in 1+1 dimensions. But this perturbation through this fixed line, this U1 cross U1 global symmetry is preserved. So that's the low energy, that's the GIR symmetry of the system. Okay. So we want to understand how the GUV, the UV symmetry is embedded into the IR symmetry. And for simplicity, let me just assume that the UV theory has continuum translation symmetry. The total charge, Q, is embedded into the IR theory as simply the total number of left movers, and the sum of the total number of left movers and the total number of right movers. Okay? And the total momentum of the UV theory is embedded into the IR theory as the Fermi momentum times the difference of the number of right and left movers. Okay? So both of these, the total charge and total momentum that generate the UV symmetries, are embedded into the IR theory in terms of this internal symmetry group of the IR theory, the U1 plus U1. These are two diagonal generators of the U1 plus U1. Right? This is just the sum of NL plus NR, and this is the difference, NR minus NL. Right? There's a famous statement about this IR global symmetry, U1 cross U1, of the Dirac fermion and one of the massless Dirac fermion plus possible four fermion interactions in 1+1D. And that's the chiral anomaly, sometimes also called the axial anomaly. And this is a prime example of the Sethoff anomaly that's of interest to me. So what it is a statement that's actually very simple to understand in kinetic matter physics. It's a statement that the separate conservation of the number of right movers and left movers is violated in the presence of an external electric field. So the equations that describe this chiral anomaly simply tell you that this continuum, the continuity equation for J left and J right, are violated when you turn on an external electromagnetic field. external electric field. And in condensed matter physics, we understand this very simply by saying that if you turn on an electric field in this direction, all the particles move from left to right. You know, the momentum shifts along the direction of the electric field. And so you deplete left movers and you create right movers. Right? So that's all there is to it. Okay. So hopefully this statement is familiar to in both condensed matter physics and in lattice gauge theory. Now let me show how the chiral anomaly leads to Ledinger's theory. Right? So let's turn on this electric field. And in the original UV theory, we know exactly what happens. Right? The rate of change of momentum is governed by Newton's law. It's the total number of, if P is the momentum density, then P is the total momentum, then dP dt is the total number of particles times the electric field. Right? That's Newton's law. Now, in the IR theory, you know, if we keep the electric field on for some a short period of time, all that will happen from the point of view of the IR theory is that you create some low energy excitations near the two Fermi points. So that's something that can be described within the IR theory. And since the momentum is implemented in the IR theory as this operator, Kf times nr minus nl, its dynamics is governed in the presence of an electric field is governed by the anomaly equation. Right? The anomaly equation of the previous slide, if I integrate this over all space, tells me that the rate of change of n left is proportional to the electric field. The rate of change of n right is also proportional to the electric field. So I take the difference, I get the rate of change of the IR momentum, which is this quantity, which is then given by Kf times E times L over pi, where L is the length of the system. Okay. Now we can compare these two statements and require that they agree. And that then relates Kf to the particle number n as Kf is pi n over L, which is precisely Ledinger's theorem. Right? So this statement, which relies only on the anomaly, makes no assumption about whether or not the system is a free fermion or is described with a fixed line of the interacting Dirac formula. Okay. So Ribu, how am I doing on time?
Technically we were supposed to finish at this point, but I think that since we had so many delays, should we maybe cut down the coffee break? Is that okay? Cut down the coffee break. So why don't you keep going then for another? Do you think 15 minutes is enough to finish the material for this lecture?
Should I go on or should I stop?
Sorry? Yeah, please go on. And we're hoping that maybe we'll give you 15 extra minutes because of the delay, and then we'll start the second lecture on time.
All right, very good. Great, thanks.
There's a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, it has to go through a microphone.
Thank you.
Senthil, this is Rajamani. I have a question on your 1D example.
Yeah.
So the anomaly you wrote down has quantization in the sense of global topology. Where does that show up in your UV theory? I'm confused. I don't know how to write the equation in the way I've said. I mean, in some sense, the electric field, I guess, has to be quantized, no?
So that's right. So the precise statement is that the coefficient in front of E over 2 pi is quantized to be an integer.
But where did you get that in the UV part?
No, in the UV, I don't have an anomaly, right? In the UV part, I just have Newton's law.
Oh, no, sorry. My question is, you said it comes from the constraint, right? And I was wondering whether there is also a constraint on the quantization also, or just the anomaly.
That's comes from the constraint. What do you mean?
So you are able to relate the chiral anomaly to the filling, right?
So the statement is that in the IR theory, there's a chiral anomaly.
Yes.
Of the emergent symmetry.
Yes.
Right. I'm able to use that to say how the momentum.
Which is what you had at the next page. Next page, right?
What I have in the next page. That's right.
Yeah. So now I was wondering, what's the consequence of the fact that the coefficient is quantized?
Right. So it tells me that I have, it gives me Leringer's theorem, right? So there's no freedom that I have. I can't make this 1.2 pi n over L. You know, it's just fixed to be pi n over L.
I see. Okay. Okay, thanks.
Sure.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Previously, you said there's some subtlety regarding whether there's some spatial coarse-graining lattice translation. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So the question is, you could pose the following question: are there lattice models which go into low energy phases or phase transitions that do not have a continuum limit?
Okay.
So those are exotic things that, as you know very well, people are talking about right now in the field, but I'm not, for my purposes, I'm not going to worry about these exotic beasts.
Okay.
I'm going to assume that a continuum limit exists.
Thank you.
Sure. Any other questions? Okay, so let me move on to 2D Landau Fermi liquids. So in two dimensions, the UV symmetry is again the global U1 times two-dimensional lattice translations, which form the group Z squared. And the IR theory is what Landau told us, which is quasi-particles near a sharp Fermi surface. There's some Fermi surface in K-space. And the IR Hamiltonian, Landau told us what this is too. It's written in terms of the quasi-particle number at point K near the Fermi surface. There's some dispersion, and these so-called forward scattering interactions, which take the structure. Now, a crucial property of the IR theory of a Fermi liquid is that it has a huge emergent symmetry, right? So colloquially, you can say that quasi-particles are separately conserved for each Fermi surface point. So in this Hamiltonian, you see that there's nothing that changes the number of quasi-particles at each point on the Fermi surface, right? So you have a separate conservation of quasi-particles for each Fermi surface point. Now, since the Fermi surface is a one-dimensional manifold, the right thing to do is to define a conserved charge density, n theta, such that n theta d theta is the number of quasi-particles between theta and theta plus d theta, right? So these generate symmetry. And the general symmetry, IR symmetry element generated by these are smooth or maps from a circle to a circle, which are given by these exponentials, where f of theta is some smooth function of theta. Okay, so these smooth maps from a circle to U1, they form a group. It's an infinite dimensional group known as the loop group. The name doesn't matter, but it's just these maps. It's the important thing to know is that it's an infinite dimensional continuous group. I'll refer to this as LU1 sometimes. And we identify this as the IR symmetry group. Okay, so there's a huge, what in 1+1 dimension, because I only had two Fermi points in 1+1, was the U1 cross U1 emergent symmetry, has been replaced in 2+1 dimensions by an infinite dimensional symmetry group associated with this large number of conservation laws that emerge in the Fermi liquid. Now let's play the same game of asking how the microscopic symmetries are embedded into the low energy theory. The total charge N is simply the sum of all the quasi-particle charges. So it's the integral of d theta and theta. Now, How about unit lattice translations along, say, the x or y direction? Unit lattice translation and setting the lattice constant to be 1 is simply generated by multiplying the phase of the fermions along the Fermi surface by e to the minus I k alpha, kf alpha, right? So this is generated, since phase rotations are generated by n theta, the symmetry element that gives you that phase change of the quasi-particles around the Fermi surface is e to the minus I integral d theta kf alpha times n theta, right? So we see that both U1 and lattice translations of the UV map to elements of the emergent internal IR symmetry of the Fermi liquid. In fact, it's very useful to take the action of translations on the IR theory to define the Fermi momentum in the IR theory, right? Irrespective of whether or not there's any true quasi-particle. Of course, here right now we're only talking about Fermi liquids, and then there's, of course, a quasi-particle. Okay? Now, so that's the emergent symmetry. There's this huge emergent symmetry, infinite dimensional symmetry, into which the global UV symmetries embed as subgroups. Okay? Now let's talk about the anomaly of this emergent symmetry. And the physical manifestation is the same as before. If we turn on an external, say, electric field, then the entire Fermi surface moves in the direction, the center of mass of the Fermi surface shifts in the direction of the electric field. This, of course, means that the separate conservation of n theta is destroyed and only the total charge is conserved. Pretty much like in the 1D example, but it's a bit more subtle here because there's an infinite number of emergent symmetries. Now, it's more entertaining in the two-dimensional case to turn on a magnetic field instead of turning on an electric field. If we turn on a magnetic field, then we know that there's a Lorentz force on the quasi-particle, and the Lorentz force is simply a V cross B force. So the rate of change of momentum of a single quasi-particle, if I create a lump of quasi-particle here, will experience a Lorentz force that caused it to move around the Fermi surface, okay? And that again tells you that there's an anomaly, because clearly if my quasi-particle can move around the Fermi surface in the presence of a magnetic field, then the number of quasi-particles at each Fermi surface point is no longer separately conserved, okay? So this simple undergraduate level physics, but we want to make a fully quantum mechanical treatment of this observation. And it's possible to do so, but to do so, to give intuition on what the treatment is, let me point out something that this picture may remind you of. So if you've been sitting in condensed matter talks in the last 15 years, you've probably heard a lot about the quorum Hall effect and topological phase of matter, where a lot of the interesting things that happen at the boundary of the system. So this picture may remind you of the boundary of an integer quorum Hall state, where there's an tidally moving edge current, okay? And indeed, that picture can be made completely precise. The Fermi surface, we know, is the boundary of the rigidly, so the Fermi surface, which is this thick line that I've drawn here, thick distorted ellipse, is the boundary of whatever's inside. And whatever's inside is the rigidly occupied Fermi C. Now, in the magnetic field, you know, the interior of the Fermi C continues to be rigid. The particles there have nowhere to go, but particles at the boundary move chirally in one direction, right? So nothing happens in the interior of the Fermi C, but there's a chiral edge state now in momentum space. In fact, we can in fact show that in the magnetic field, the Fermi C can be thought of as showing an integer quorum Hall effect in momentum space, right? So this is intuitive, but it can be made completely precise, and that's enables us to have that precise picture. The precise version of this gives us a handle on a completely quantum treatment of the anomaly. So the formal manifestation of the anomaly is thus following. So if I turn on a 2-pi magnetic flux, so the electromagnetic field, right, of the external electromagnetic field, turn on a vector potential Ax and Ay, in momentum space, I argued that there's a chiral edge state in K space. And this, for this chiral K space edge state at the Fermi surface, these n thetas, which were formerly conserved, but are no longer conserved, they satisfy an algebra that's familiar from the theory of the integer quantum Hall edge state. So there's a chiral fermion that's moving around in momentum space. So they, like for any other chiral fermion, there's a chiral Katz-Moody algebra, which tells you that the n thetas, which earlier in the absence of a magnetic field were commuting observables, now they no longer commute, but rather they're commutators given by this familiar expression, which involves the derivative of a Dirac delta function. Okay? So this is the so-called Katz-Moody algebra, the U1 Katz-Moody algebra for a chiral fermion. And that emerges now as a description of the Fermi surface state in a magnetic field. Okay? So this is the absolutely precise formal statement of the anomaly. Now let's see how Luttinger's theorem emerges from this anomaly. Right? So in the UV theory, if I turn on a 2-pi magnetic flux and spread it out so that spread it out over some long distance, I can ask about the fate of translations. Now, translations along X and Y commute in the absence of a magnetic field. But once I have a magnetic field, we know that translations become projective. They no longer commute with each other. You have a magnetic translation group. And the lack of commutativity is determined by the charge filling nu. And the rough way, the intuitive way to understand this equation is that instead of translating the particle in the presence of 2-pi flux, we can translate the flux in the presence of a fixed lattice. So I translate the flux around the particle this way. I pick up an Arnaud Bohm phase, which is determined by the average charge at each site. The average charge at each site is nu. So the Arnaud Bohm phase is 2-pi nu. And so that precisely captures this lack of commutativity of Tx and Ty. So this is the statement in the UV theory. So now we want to reproduce the statement in the IR theory. Right? In the IR theory, we know that the T alphas are realized in terms of these elements of this infinite dimensional symmetry, as I described in the couple of slides back. So this operator, what it does is to rotate the phase of each fermion by an amount e to the minus I A alpha KF alpha of theta, which is exactly what lattice translations does in the IR theory. But now, in the presence of 2-pi flux, then thetas no longer commute with each other, but satisfy this equation. So using this, we can readily calculate this quantity. Now, once we know how the algebra of n thetas, their exponentials, we can easily calculate this quantity. And we get a number, we get a pure phase, which is determined by the volume of the Fermi surface times the volume of the unit cell. So we demand that these two things equal each other, right? And that equality gives us Luttinger's theorem, right? It relates the volume of the Fermi surface to the lattice filling independently of any other consideration, right? So there's an absolutely non-perturbative way to think about Luttinger's theorem. And so I'm almost done with this story. So apart from Luttinger's theorem, several other universal properties of the Fermi liquid follow just from knowing its emergent symmetry and its anomaly. Right? So these kinds of properties, which I'll call kinematic properties, must be distinguished from dynamical properties that require detailed knowledge of the IR Hamiltonian. For instance, you may need to know the Fermi velocity and things of that sort. Right? So there's a lot to be gained by so these kinematic properties are easier to get a handle on. And that's perhaps one direction for progress as compared to the more difficult problem of understanding the dynamical properties of the low energy theory. Okay? So let me, I'm almost ready to stop. Let me skip all these advanced comments. Let me just say one last thing about more general compressible phases, which are not necessarily Fermi liquids, and then I'll really stop. Okay? So one of the things we were able to do is to prove what we call a generalized Schrödinger's theorem, but really it's much more than Schrödinger's theorem. Schrödinger's theorem is a small consequence. For any general compressible phase in D bigger than one, and with GUV is U1 times the lattice translation, then the IR theory, we can argue, must have a large emergent continuous internal symmetry group, GAR. Under some conditions, we can prove rigorously that it cannot be any compactly grouped. And furthermore, the GAR must have a precise anomaly that's related to the lattice filling. Okay, so that's a general result. Of particular interest, and this the very last thing I'm going to say, is that the emergent internal symmetry of a class of non-Fermi liquid metals with these conditions, perhaps it's the same as the Fermi liquid. So the emergent internal symmetry and the anomaly may be the same as the Fermi liquid, though the detailed dynamical properties may be different. And there are many examples in the literature of this class of non-Fermi liquid metals, is what we called Assert's Fermi liquids. Now, other more exotic structures of emergent symmetries is definitely possible. By the time I made the slide, I thought it may be possible, but now we know that it's definitely possible. But this class of Assert's Fermi liquids, which share the same emergent symmetry and anomaly as Fermi liquid, is already very rich and poorly understood. And so that's perhaps the place, a target for progress in the short run. And in the next talk, I'll talk about some recent progress that we made on understanding one such example of an Assert's Fermi liquid. So let me stop there. And thank you all for listening and bearing with all the technical problems.
All right, we have a few minutes, maybe just if there are one or two questions, and then we can have our coffee break and come back. Emily, do you know if it's okay if we start a little later for the second part? It should be, we'll. But first, if there are there questions about? Here's a question.
Can I ask a question?
Is that coming from outside this room? So let's go Lucas first.
Hi, can you hear me?
Sure.
Okay, my question is on anomalies, anomalous breaking. There are different possible breakings of symmetry, anomalous breaking and explicit breaking. I didn't really, usually when I think of anomalous breaking of symmetry, we think of a symmetry that is broken due to the quantization, a symmetry that, the measure of the path integral does not have, while the microscopic action does have it. Is this the same here? So why is it not an explicit symmetry breaking if you add an electric field?
Right. So there's various kinds of anomalies, right? So the particular kind of anomaly that I'm talking about here is the Latouf anomaly, which is global symmetry that's present in the system, but that global symmetry is naively violated in the presence of an external gauge field that couples to that, that gauges that symmetry, right? And the technical way in which that the external gauge field, the background gauge field, violates that symmetry is precisely what you said. The action itself may look invariant, but the measure is not invariant, right? Now, the Tooth anomalies can be thought of. So one way to think about it is that there is a way to make the action gauge, to make the path integral gauge invariant, which is to extend the, suppose my dynamical theory lives in D plus one space-time dimensions, And then I couple it to a background gauge field that also lives in deep response space-time dimensions, then the theory doesn't look gauge invariant, right? But if I extend my gauge fields, but not the dynamical degrees of freedom, just extend the background gauge field to one higher dimension, right? Then I can write a gauge invariant action that includes a gauge invariant partition function that factorizes a sum of two contributions. One is a boundary contribution, which naively is not gauge invariant, and the other is a bulk contribution, which also naively is not gauge invariant, but the bulk contribution has some topological action. And these two combined together to give me something that's gauge invariant. Right? I think field theorists say this anomaly inflow from the bulk into the boundary that cancels the lack of gauge invariance in the boundary. Does that help? Or
He says yes.
Okay, very good. Thanks.
We have another question in the back.
This can be a quick question. Here you just considered lattice translations, but what about space group symmetries, rotations, or non-symmorphic symmetries? How do they like enrich the story here?
So that's not something that I've explored particularly. Lattice translation is important because charge filling and that U1 in lattice translation is important because of things like charge filling and compressibility and things of that sort. Now, if you, as you take into account more symmetries of the system, point group, rotations, reflections, those will definitely enrich the story somewhat. But the most subtle aspects, I think associated with the symmetries that I'm dealing with currently, but it's for the future to worry about these. So we made a choice based on where we thought the most subtle aspects and most useful lessons will come from, right? As this line of thought progresses, it will be good to think about, the other kinds of symmetries that you're bringing up.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, there's one question from Zoom. Someone has over Zoom. So just unmute yourself and ask your question. But in the future, please raise your hand or put the question in chat. And then when you're asked to unmute yourself, you can ask a question. So please go ahead.
Yeah. The question is about this picture of integer quantum Hall effect in momentum space. Can I also generalize that to fractional quantum Hall effects in momentum space? What does it mean?
The point here is that the bulk is sort of dead, right? It's a rigid Fermi C, right? There's nothing going on in the bulk. Now, I'm not sure what it means to generalize it to a fractional quantum Hall at the edge. Then the bulk needs to have something non-trivial going on.
Yeah.
Right. So, I don't know, it's a wild thought, perfect for young and adventurous postdocs to pursue.
Thank you.
So Senthil, I have a question. I have two questions maybe. Yeah. First, a very simple question is what you discuss, is there a reason that you discuss it in two dimension and not higher dimension than two dimensions?
So we can give a similar discussion in higher dimension as well. But most of the non-Fermi liquids that I would be very happy, let me put it this way. I'd be very happy if I can make progress on two-dimensional non-Fermi liquid metals. Right?
Yeah.
And so let's take it once, in 1+1D, we understand a great deal about non-Fermi liquids, right? Schrodinger mm-hmm. liquids. In 2+1D, we understand very little, right? And there's many empirical examples of 2+1 dimensional non-Fermi liquids. So let me try to do that first, right?
My question was just at the level of the argument you made. It seemed that I couldn't see why it wouldn't work in three dimensions.
A lot of this discussion will go through in three dimensions without too much modification.
I see. Okay.
Right? The the heuristic arguments that I gave will have to change, but the more formal arguments in terms of what the anomaly is and what the bulk topological action is that gives this anomaly inflows, those kinds of things just go through to any dimension without modification.
Okay, and the second question I had was that you had this Hamiltonian, which was EK, NK plus FKK, NK, NK prime.
So yeah.
Were you proposing that as a sort of fixed point Hamiltonian that describes the infrared theory?
For a Fermi liquid, yeah.
For a Fermi liquid. So the question is, how do you know this is a fixed point, and what do you know about the stability of this fixed point?
Yeah, so for a Landau Fermi liquid, first of all, this is what Landau said, right? So by definition, it's his Fermi liquid, right? So whatever he said is by definition the answer. But it's really a fixed surface. You know, there's modern treatments. So there's modern treatments of RG treatments of Fermi liquid. I say modern, but it's probably older than most of the students in the room by R. Shankar. Also later by Joe Polchinski, which obtained this as the fixed point theory of a Fermi liquid in any dimension. It's really a fixed surface that's parametrized by these Landau functions F. So there's a fixed so there is an RG fixed point. Now in terms of stability, you know, we know that there's a famous instability of the Fermi liquid, which is the superunitary instability, right? And that's within this RG treatment of Shankar, that does show up as a runaway RG flow in the BCS channel. So really what we're describing is the Fermi liquid fixed point, where we imagine the bare BCS coupling is so small that we come very close to this fixed point. We're really trying to understand the property of the normal metallic state and ignoring the fact that eventually the system may become a subunitary.